Felicia Mebbin. And this is Health Services Unplugged. Here's an important question. How is health policy or health services research connected to Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old Black man who died on April 19, 2015, a week after he was injured after being arrested by Baltimore police? The answer? Through Dr. Sarah Bleich. Dr. Bleich grew up in Baltimore, and years before the treatment of Black men by some police officers captured headlines again in 2015, she was using her expertise to help Black youth with a health issue that affects them more than others, obesity. Listen in as we make these connections with Mr. Joe Whitmore, a teacher in Richmond, Virginia, and learn more about him, Dr. Bleich, and her research.
So, truth in advertising, I know both of you. And I thought that this might be a good way to round out the introduction to the podcast, which is to have a couple of people who I know who are great and fit the category for guests for the podcast. So Sarah and I graduated from the same PhD program at Harvard University. Sarah, where did you graduate before that?
So prior to that, I did my undergrad at Columbia University and did a BA in psychology, took 2 years off and did public health consulting, and then I went into the doctoral program at Harvard.
So Joe and I met when I was a dean of students at the UNC Gillan School of Global Public Health, and I was also the director of a summer public health fellowship program, and Joe was a fellow. So Joe, where did you graduate and what did you concentrate on?
So in 2011, I graduated from Virginia Tech, which was a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and a Bachelor of Science in Human Nutrition, Food, and Exercise. And when I finished graduating, I sort of followed the health behavior, health education route, more so the education by teaching. I taught elementary school, second grade for a year, and then I went on to teach middle school social studies, which is what I currently teach in Richmond, Virginia.
Thought it would be a good idea to try the two-guest format with an expert and an unexpected guest who wouldn't mind trying this with me for the first time. So thank goodness we did try because I had some technical difficulties the first time. So this is take two. So I thank both of you for being patient with me. So Sarah, I thought of you as an expert guest for several reasons, one of which is the fact that you're here in Baltimore. As many of our listeners will know, in recent weeks, Baltimore has been in the news because of the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. His death prompted demonstrations, discussions, and some civil unrest. I don't know what we would want to call it, but not enough discussion, I think, about the longer-term causes of the police's reaction and the issues facing communities like Freddie Gray's. I saw some reports in the aftermath of what happened on differences in life expectancy in neighborhoods a few miles apart in the Baltimore area, but I think not enough on the specifics of what we can do to make things better for communities aside from issues related to the police. So all of this prompted me to think about how health services research can help communities, particularly communities struggling with poverty and health disparities. So I was wondering first, Sarah, did you go there when you heard about what was happening? In other words, did you connect what was happening around Freddie Gray's death to the work that you're doing here at Hopkins?
So my first thought when everything happened with Freddie Gray was, how would my research have played out differently, which was conducted in the neighborhoods where the riots happened a couple of years ago, had the riots already happened? And what was very striking to me, the research that I did was looking at the impact of calorie information that's easy to understand and whether or not when you make it meaningful to people, if you have an impact on their behavior when it comes to buying sugary beverages like soda. And when we first got the money for the study, I was thrilled. I started driving around West Baltimore, Sandtown, which is exactly where Freddie Gray was killed. There are boarded up houses everywhere. And I got really depressed and I thought, this is never going to work. And we did it once and it worked. We did it again and it worked. And I thought to myself, This is targeting Black adolescents who are high risk for sugary beverages. They're at high risk for obesity. They have all sorts of social disadvantage to live in these neighborhoods, and they still care about their health, and they care about the calories when you give it to them in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm, the information. So when you said it wasn't going to work, what did you mean specifically?
I thought that if I simply gave a kid information about calories, they wouldn't care because they have so many other things that are going on in their lives.
Okay.
If they don't have access to good schools, if they don't have a solid family structure, if they see drug trades all the time, if they have older brothers or younger siblings who are in the criminal justice system, is this something that's really going to sway them? Is it meaningful? And in fact, when you just posted information about calories on beverage cases as someone is making a decision, mm-hmm. it seems to actually matter for Black adolescents. And so when everything was happening with these riots and a lot of the unrest was being pushed by youth who were very much in the age range of the kids in my study, it to me just sounded like it was a huge call for help and for attention and for need. And it's interesting because if you've read the Baltimore Sun over the past several decades, which I have, and I've read them for the last decade or something, what you find is that there has been constant reporting about issues of poverty and segregation and the challenges that these West Baltimore communities face. But now that it's in the national spotlight, there's a real federal interest in trying to rebuild the city. So my hope is that we in public health can work with people in the state, people in the city, and think about how do we pair social services with poverty alleviation services, with the health and all approach to really help these communities rebuild in a way that's meaningful and that will promote their personal health.
Mm-hmm. So again, you do see that health services can have a concrete, specific role in helping these communities to deal with some of the issues that they're dealing with.
I think population health is really important. It is certainly important from a healthcare perspective that people have access to care, but those are often very discrete contacts that are often based on acute events. So you break your arm or you get sick and you go to the ER. But the systemic poverty and the sort of poor health that that breeds needs population-based approaches. And so we need to think about, in these communities, do you have access to healthy food? Do you understand what it means to eat healthy food that is ingrained in you through the education system? Are there social safety nets to catch you if you don't have parents that can help you make good decisions? So I think that there is definitely a role for public health, but to have an impact on places like Sandtown or anywhere in the country where there is systemic poverty and potentially unrest, it has to be done in concert. Public health can't do it alone. Education can't do it alone. City planning can't do it alone. And so there's a real need for different silos to really work together to think creatively about how to maximize limited city or federal resources and really try to reach these communities.
So Joe, I want you to jump in here because we've talked about city planning with you.
Right.
We've talked about public health, about education. I mean, all of those are issues I know you're interested in.
Right. Absolutely. So as you've been talking, Sarah, I've related what you've been saying to a lesson that we actually just had today in my eighth grade civics class. And that's how does the public agenda shape public policy? And so I think as you were talking, I was kind of thinking, what can you take from your study or what are pieces that you could take from your study specifically and, you know, apply them to the school so that you reach a broader audience or a larger audience? So what are some pieces that you found could be translated, whether that's, you know, offering advice to policymakers or going into the schools individually? What are some ways that we could reach a broader audience, let's say, in a school?
So the take-home point for me from the study, and just to give listeners a bit of background, the idea of it was we know that federally, calories are going to be posted in food outlets, supposed to be beginning December 1st, 2015, so about 6 or 8 months from now. And prior to that federal legislation being passed in 2010, many localities, probably upwards of a dozen around the country, starting with New York City, had these local labeling laws. So you'd walk into a chain restaurant, you would see calories posted on the menu. And our feeling was that the typical person, be they rich, poor, Black or white, has no sense of calories. And so if you give people calories in a way that matters to them, perhaps you can impact their behavior. And so the study setup was to go into corner stores, which are very prevalent in low-income urban communities, often where many of the food sources come from, give kids information about the calories in a bottle of soda, one piece of information at a time, and then see how they react. And so the four signs that were tested in the most recent study were absolute calories, meaning that a bottle of soda has 250 calories. And then we also gave them that exact same piece of information, but in a meaningful way. So we said it's 5 miles of walking, 50 minutes of running, or 14 teaspoons of sugar. And what we found is that it's the miles of walking sign that seems to matter most. But big picture, Joe, to answer your question, you know, what are the takeaways? For me, it is that if you want to reach people and you want to have them change behavior, you just have to communicate in a meaningful way, be it about soda or food or education or any other message that you want to convey. It has to meet people where they are, in part because we all learn differently, but more importantly, we are inundated with information all the time. And you can't assume that just by giving someone numbers that they are going to make sense of them and how they apply to them personally, particularly because not only does a typical American know very little about calories, but they also know very little about how many calories they need total in a given day. And we're also very bad at math as Americans. So if you know, for example, that a hamburger has 500 calories, and you know that you need about 2,000 calories a day, being able to mentally figure out what fraction of 500 is in 2,000 is very challenging for the typical American.
All right, so let's approach this, you know, a little more succinctly. What would be the interesting, fun way that you could get this to a broader group of students like Joe's class?
It seems to me you need to pick an activity that people don't like to do, like running or walking. The average person does not like doing that.
I'd say most people.
Most people. The average person. So we pilot tested this with a bunch of different kids. And we said, what if we said minutes of basketball, minutes of yoga, minutes of soccer? And we had this whole list of activities, some of which are a little bit more desirable, some of which are not. And it always came back to running and walking. If you tell me I have to do that, I'm not going to want to drink that soda.
Right. And if I can piggyback off of that, I think, you know, one thing that teachers strive to do, or at least should strive to do, is present to the students problems. Students really like to be problem solvers, no matter what the situation is. So even if we take this problem back to Baltimore, you know, if you're able to access students and say, look, here's our problem, you know, X amount of drinks are being consumed, which is translating into this issue, how can we fix it? I think they're very willing, and I've had it in my classroom, they're very willing to do the research to make it reach a broader audience. They like to do that work. They like to do the research behind it. And so as far as making the posters or making it more chewable for everyone, I'm in favor of presenting the students with the problem and let them problem solve to see how they can reach their community specifically, because they're the ones that are living in their community and they know what their community needs and what their community responds to. So if their communities are walkers or lacrosse players or, you know, runners, they know how to reach that community. So mm-hmm. I think that would be, in addition to what Sarah said, effective.
And another fun translation could be local cuisine. So here mm-hmm. in Baltimore, we eat lots of crab cakes. Somewhere else, you may eat a lot of cheesesteaks. And so right. if you put it in terms of X number of minutes for favorite local cuisine, people get that and they right. understand and it matters.
Right. Sarah, I think this podcast is a bit an opportunity for people to get a little bit of you behind the scenes of research. And your article mentions a bit that you had to go out and talk to the store owners and convince them or whatever. So tell us a little bit about that process, like how you identified the stores and how you got them to participate.
So the process of identifying the stores was solid and scientific and very upstanding. The process of getting the stores was tricky and challenging and unexpected.
Okay.
So the process scientifically was simply to say you had to meet certain qualifications. You had to be within a certain number of city blocks of a middle or high school because we're targeting adolescents. You had to be sitting within a neighborhood that was at least 70% Black based on the census because we're targeting Black kids. And we're doing everything based on sight, because the minute you interact with a kid, you're modifying the impact of information on behavior. So mm-hmm. we wanted the pure effects. So we're just watching their purchases in stores. And they also had to have water and diet soda available for purchase.
You mean, so some of them didn't? Because when I read that, I thought, well, who doesn't have water and right. diet soda in the store?
So I had my little Hopkins badge, and I just started going all around Baltimore. And there's no shortage of these corner stores. They're everywhere. Interestingly, in the Baltimore landscape, about 90% of the stores are actually Korean-owned, located in predominantly Black neighborhoods. And so I went to a bunch of the stores, and in about a third to 40%, either they didn't have water and diet soda available, and they were interested, but they didn't sell those items, so they weren't qualified. Mm-hmm. In most of the stores that said no, the questions were, so you want to get kids to buy fewer sugary beverages?
Oh, I see.
To which I would say, yes.
Right.
And they'd say, absolutely not. That's our biggest profit maker.
Right.
And so at that point, there was nothing I could say about whether or not this was cost neutral. So is it the case that a kid's thirsty and so they buy a water instead of a soda? Or is it the case that a kid buys nothing at all? And without that evidence, it was very hard to get buy-in from the stores. So we did eventually get enough stores. But the challenge of finding the right stores speaks to the broader issue of trying to do research in communities, because my bottom line is to maximize health, a totally noble activity. If you're a small store, your bottom line is to maximize profits, also a totally noble activity. And it's finding that sweet spot mm-hmm. where you can maximize profits and maximize health. And this study is not that, mm-hmm. because what we did find, in fact, is that while there was some replacement where kids are choosing to buy water instead of soda or diet soda instead of regular soda, we actually had some kids that walked in and bought nothing at all. Now, I haven't priced it out, so I don't know if it impacted the bottom line, but that's not desirable from a profit maximization perspective.
Right. Sweet spot, but not quite as sweet as it was before, right?
Yeah. Right.
Joe, did you want to jump in?
No, I think that that's a very fine line to have. And I think it's going to be hard, like you said, in a community where their main income is that to offer themselves as part of your study.
So have you had a chance to share this with community, local community? Did you go back to the communities and say, here's what we found?
So I've done less with the individual stores and more on a lot of local radio. Mm-hmm. So there was all the natural circuits on like NPR and the more academic type radio stations. But I did a lot on the local FM stations to sort of get the message out there. Mm-hmm. I also created some press kits to share. It's a little bit too intensive for me as one person to go store by store, but it is possible to create buzz by talking to, say, the Corner Store Association or something like that. And, you know, I think that we need a little bit more evidence to really compel them. But generally here in Baltimore, we have found that stores are relatively amenable to participating in research, so long as throughout the process, we're not hurting their sales. Mm-hmm. And I think that this was a year-long study that happened throughout the course of one school year. They could have kicked us out, and they didn't. So my sense is that we didn't impact stores. And some of these stores were in both studies. So I think if we were to cost this out, which we don't have the data to do that, but if we were to do that, I think we find that it's actually not hurting the stores. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that for certain.
As sure. a reminder, you did two studies.
That's right. We did two studies, both funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The key distinction between the two, both had the overarching goal of asking the question, if you give kids information about calories that's easy to understand in the real world when they're going to actually purchase a soda, can you change their behavior? The punchline from both is yes, information about calories in a meaningful way will impact the purchases of soda. You'll buy fewer sodas, fewer calories, fewer large volume beverages, and then in some cases, kids are actually choosing not to buy anything. A key distinction between study one and study two is we thought, well, what happens when the world goes back to usual and the mm-hmm. signs come down, which is typical in any study. Mm-hmm. There's a start, there's an end, and then life returns. And that actually hadn't been looked at in this context or in many other contexts, the persistent intervention effect. And what we found, in fact, was that once all the signs came down and these stores were returned to normal, the kids actually kept buying fewer sodas, and they kept buying fewer calories, and they kept buying large volume, meaning bigger than 16 ounces. So that was incredibly encouraging, both because they learned something, but more importantly, this was a really low-cost study, and so it is replicatable, and we have ourselves replicated it twice. And this idea of using easy-to-understand calories has been picked up a lot and replicated by a lot of different research groups around the country, and it's been picked up by departments of public health around the country in their campaigns. So we're really encouraged by it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, replication is the idea that other people will do a similar study on different populations or other populations or more of the population to see if the findings stand up, and that's an important part of the research process.
That's exactly right. And one thing that I think that's important to point out is that our focus in both studies was Black adolescents who are at higher risk for obesity and sugary beverage consumption. The replication studies have focused on all sorts of groups, middle-income white women, young white kids, and they're all finding the same thing, which sort of says this is a technique which seems to be universally persuasive.
Joe, did you want to ask anything about the studies?
Yeah, I'm curious if you guys explored the opportunity of offering substitutes, or were you just trying to educate them?
We thought about that. It's a great point. So we could have had the sign say, did you know that a bottle of soda is 5 miles of walking? Try this instead. Try seltzer water. Try water. Try diet soda. And we didn't do that because then we weren't sure if we were going to be able to see the pure effect of the calorie information, or was it the substitute that was driving their behavior. So we didn't. But you raise a really important point, which is when substitutions happen, which they are because we're seeing shifts in behavior, what are kids substituting for?
Right.
And this was actually a really interesting finding. So in study one, we saw a drop in soda purchases and an uptick in fruit drink. So these are not apple or orange juice, which are 100% juice. These are things that are like 5% juice, 10% juice. So they have as much sugar as soda, if not more in some cases. And we saw an uptick. In study two, we again saw a big uptick in fruit drink purchases. And so on the front end, we had talked to a bunch of kids. And in addition to sort of asking them which sorts of activities persuade you to not buy something, we also showed them a huge variety of beverages. And anytime it was a fruit-based beverage that had a piece of fruit on the cover, on the label, they always said it was healthy. Even if we then explained, but it's actually more calories than soda, it's actually 5% juice, it was always seeing that fruit that pushed them to think that it was healthy. And so I think what's happening is that some of the kids are seeing this sign. They're thinking, okay, well, soda's bad, it's a sugary beverage, but fruit juice, that's great. And so I think that's what's driving that substitution. And so that's where education could actually be really powerful for the kids that are thinking of switching. Can you steer them with the signage towards something else? And what I can tell you is that when New York did their ad campaign based on pouring on the pounds, where you see them in still and in video, you basically see a soda bottle and fat is pouring out of it to identify the amount of fat you would gain if you drank a certain amount of soda every day for a year. Mm-hmm. In that, they say, try seltzer water and water. And they actually present an alternative for people thinking about making the choice. We didn't do that, but I do think it's important.
Because there's the difference between doing a research study and having an information campaign, because the research study needs to tease out the effects of specific things that you do, whereas a campaign can have multiple concepts and, you know, be effective as well.
That's right. And we were specifically trying to inform the current legislation, which is simply posting calories. And our argument is that so now this space has been created on menu boards around the country. Calories will be posted in almost every food outlet, entertainment places like amusement parks, movie theaters, restaurants, even in some grocery stores that carry prepackaged cooked food. And so if there's space is going to be made available, can we better maximize it? So we were just trying to take that little bit of real estate and make it more valuable.
Mm-hmm. And then you go to questions like Joe's. Okay, now that we know that this works, you know, how can we take it to the next level? Okay, so tell me something, Sarah, that you haven't told anybody else that interviewed you about this study.
So one really interesting thing, and this sort of gets back to the first topic we talked about, which is Baltimore unrest, is that when I was walking around all these neighborhoods and I was doing the first study, I would often buy something in the stores. If you take 20 minutes to talk to me, I'll be happy to buy something. Mm-hmm. And so in one of the stores, I purchased a bag of pretzels. This was 4 years ago. I purchased a bag of pretzels, normal size, snack size, maybe 4 ounces, and an off-brand can of diet soda. Mm-hmm. And it cost 65 cents for both those items. And I was shocked because I thought, you can have almost no money and purchase a tremendous amount of calories. Had I purchased a can of sugary soda and a bag of a really high calorie snack, I could have bought 1,000 calories for less than a dollar. Mm-hmm. Right. And it just is very telling of the types of foods that are available and cheap and accessible and palatable to these kids in these neighborhoods. And there aren't that many alternatives. And so that just put a fire under my tush to really try to do my small part. And then also, I grew up in a neighborhood in Baltimore City, going back and forth to one of these corner stores as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I would get an allowance every weekend, and it was $2. And I was allowed to spend it all at once, or I could save it. And for the first year, I was 6 years old. I could walk to the store by myself. I would always go and buy potato chips. And I'd buy, you can buy a lot of potato chips for $2 based on my illustration of 4 years ago. Imagine 30 years ago. And I gained weight very quickly in that year from 6 to 7. Mm-hmm. And it was because I was loading up on potato chips all week and with my $2. And so when I took the job at Hopkins, I made a promise to myself. And I said, I grew up in one of these low-income neighborhoods. I have to give back. I know what these kids are doing. I've done it. I need to do my part.
That's great. That's great. Seems like you've already answered this question a bit, but tell us a little bit more about what motivated you to pursue this particular career.
So I originally thought that I wanted to be a doctor. I come from a family of, on one side, teachers and health professionals. Didn't think I wanted to be a teacher, so I thought, I'll be a doctor. And then I realized that my personality is a little bit too impatient to deal with one patient at a time. And I like the idea of, how do you keep a person from going to see the doctor? How do you keep them off the table and keep them healthy? Mm-hmm. And so I sort of fell into public health as a job between undergrad and graduate school. And after working at a small firm where our job was to be public health consultants, mm-hmm. and sort of tell the evaluation story of local events happening in LA County, I fell in love with it. And so I fortunately applied and was accepted to the Harvard PhD program in health policy, where I started about 2 years after graduating from undergrad, which is where I met you. Mm-hmm. And after I got in, it was a huge deal. My family is very diverse economically, where one side was very poor. My mm-hmm. grandfather was a corn farmer with little formal education. And the other side was from the Upper East Side, and my grandfather on that side was a physician in New York City. So very different worlds. And both played a large role in raising me. And so when I got into Harvard, it was a huge deal for everyone, but particularly for my grandpa, who was the corn farmer. And so I was living in California, coming to Boston, and stopped in Maryland on the way to Boston. And I went to see my corn farmer grandpa, and he pulled me aside and he said, Sarah, don't you go up there to Harvard and get uppity. And I said, oh, grandpa, whatever. And I sort of waved it off. And then I finished my coursework, and it was time for me to pick the topic, which I'm going to dedicate my dissertation to and likely the work after. And his words came back to me. And I thought to myself, I'm going to study obesity. For all sorts of personal reasons, because the average person can understand it. You don't need a lot of fancy degrees. You don't need to know a lot about health. Mm-hmm. And I told my grandpa, I remember calling him up, and I said, Grandpa, I'm going to study obesity. And he said, baby, you're going to make fat people thin. And I said, yes, Grandpa, I'm going to address the obesity problem. And, you know, it's been 15 years since we had that conversation. Mm-hmm. I've never looked back, and I have yet to meet someone anywhere, on a public bus, in the supermarket, on a plane or a train, mm-hmm. who I can't have a fun conversation with, who has not dealt with this on some personal level. So it's been hugely gratifying mm-hmm. for me personally, because I feel like I'm helping real people in their real lives.
So Joe, is there anything you want to ask Sarah as we're getting to the end here?
Anything to ask Sarah? So this hits home a lot. Public health hit home a lot, and which is why I got into health education, because at one point I loved health behavior, health education. At one point, the whole reason I did the fellowship was to potentially pursue a career in obesity and health behavior, health education, and then I just went the education route. So I guess my question, and we've kind of addressed it already, but how do you foresee studies like this effectively shaping policy?
I think about that all the time, and one of the interesting things in a lot of public health research, and definitely for obesity, is that much of the policy innovation bubbles up from local examples. Right. That is definitely the case with menu labeling, which we had about 12 to 20 places around the country, some cities, some states, that made the decision as a locality to adopt that rule, saying if you walk into a chain restaurant, menus will be posted on menu boards alongside price. And now it's federal legislation included in the Affordable Care Act. And so this specific work was energized by all that effort federally and locally around menu labeling. And I think that, Joe, the way to push it forward from a policy perspective is probably not to focus on the big chains that have to make mm-hmm. big corporate decisions, but to focus on the smaller chains who have a much more control over their menu boards and are interested actually in innovating as a way to attract clientele who care about the health choices that they make. We're seeing a lot more of that. We're seeing large-scale companies switch to organic. We're seeing large-scale companies
like
Chipotle making non-GMO announcements. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is a marketing, potentially a marketing tool for restaurants. And I think the way to pitch it to them is in that way, to say, look, customers want this information. Help them make better decisions, and they will come to you because of your transparency.
Okay, I want to take this all the way over to the fun side for just a few minutes. So I'm asking everybody something about how do they spend fun time. So, and I love movies, so I'm asking everybody about movies. So, Sarah, what's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie is probably The Usual Suspects. Because, you know, typically in life, when you hear hoofbeats, it's a horse. In that movie, when you hear hoofbeats, it's a zebra. And it really caught me off guard. It's the last movie that surprised me.
Oh, that's interesting. Joe, what about you?
So I'm a huge movie buff, and this is a really, really hard question. But, I mean, hands down, Lord of the Rings. I watch them any time of the day, any time of the year, multiple times over and over again. Uh-huh. I think there's just too much depth and too much value in those movies to not say anything else. So,
and Lord fun. Of the Rings. I mean, come on. Yeah, absolutely. Like, entertainment value is awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is a hard question. I personally don't like those. What's your favorite? But I thought I'd give it a try anyway.
No, it's a good question. A good question.
I mean, I like lots of movies, and part of the reason I bring it up is I'm hoping maybe folks who do the type of research that Sarah does, and it's really great that you're talking to communities through the radio. I'm hoping that more of us will get out there and be involved in things like movies and TV shows, and, you know, in other words, taking some of these messages to where people are and how they get a lot of information. Thanks to both of you. This has been fun, and I really appreciated you supporting the podcast this way. So any final messages or thoughts?
I guess a final message from me would be that one of the wonderful things about a life of academic research is that it gives you an opportunity to potentially impact real people. But I think it also gives you an opportunity to live a real life, because from my experience, there is good work-life balance, because it is up to you to get your work done. In my case, I have two little ones who are almost two and almost four. And so if I have to leave work in the middle of the day, I can work in the middle of the night. And so while not optimal from a sleep perspective, it is optimal from a mommy perspective. And so I think that I can be a good mom and a good professor at the same time.
And thanks for sharing that, because it is important for people to know what kind of options they have in order to have families, if that's what they want to do, or work, or in order to have the balance, if that's what they want. So, Joe.
So I want to put a very quick plug in to all the educators that will be listening to this podcast, because I teach social studies, and here I am sitting in gratefully on a podcast that has to do with sugar sweetened beverage and obesity, and I think it's fascinating. So all the teachers out there, don't stick to your content. Challenge your students to think outside of the box, put up public issues that are currently happening in the United States, and have your kids problem solve. Have them figure out how they can be, I always say, the students are the generation of the future, will make it happen. So that's my sort of my end note. I'm going to step off my pedestal, but that's just a challenge to all the teachers out there, is to really get your kids thinking about problem solving.
I like your pedestal, Joe. Thank you. Okay, so, I mean, that's it. So thank you, guys. That was awesome.
That was good, Joe. Those are very wise words.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank
that
you.
That was really great. So, I appreciate it. A big thanks to Dr. Sarah Bleich, a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and my unexpected guest, Mr. Joe Whitmore, a teacher in Richmond, Virginia. And thanks to you for listening in. You can join in with your comments and other feedback and find links to more about what we talked about, including Dr. Bleich's obesity studies, at healthservicesunplugged.info. Health Services Unplugged is presented by Academy Health with support from Kaiser Permanente and produced by me, Dr. Felicia Medin, and executive producer, Dr. Imani Cheers, with music by Dr. Cheryl Medin. You can learn more about this project and the rest of Academy Health at academyhealth.org.